I'm Support for WKAR is provided by Fluke Hearing, featuring American-made products that provide hearing technology for every lifestyle and life stage, with 8 locations throughout mid-Michigan, flukehearing.com. And by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu.
Welcome to our Friday edition of Current State here on WKAR. It's great to have you along. I'm Mark Bayshore. We've got a lot of great things in the show here for you. Coming up, a Detroit spoken word artist, Jamal May, who will be performing and appearing in East Lansing here this weekend. There's all kinds of interesting work going on at Peckham in Lansing. It's called Art at Work. We've got the Free Press's Joe Rexroad coming up and lots more here to get to before 10 o'clock this morning. Last Wednesday, Governor Rick Snyder ordered a review of how Michigan delivers mental health services. Commissions headed by Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly will focus on how to close the gap for people who need help but who end up in jail instead, and several other issues as well. For a bit more perspective, here's the governor just over a month ago in his State of the State address.
We started investing in that, and we've done some good work with mental health courts. But the issue is we should be doing more to help people before they show up before a judge. So what I'm saying is we need to work together in partnership. We'll put additional budget resources towards, but we need to partner on coming up with great demonstration projects on how to engage mental health issues more effectively, get communities more involved, create more public-private partnerships, and take care of people that deserve better attention that will benefit all of us.
Bob Sheehan is Executive Director of Community Mental Health in Lansing. CMH serves Ingham, Eaton, and Clinton counties, and we wanted to get his perspective on this review. Good morning, Bob.
Morning, Mark.
How do you feel about this state review, then?
I think it's a good idea. Whenever we can heighten the dialogue around mental health issues, it's a good thing for all of us.
But is it overdue in some respect? I mean, is there enough that needs work that now is especially appropriate time?
You know, I think it is overdue. Some of the issues the governor's raised and others have been around for 30 years. We've been raising them for 30 years, that you have a strong system in Michigan, but there are some significant gaps, and they aren't new gaps. I think the public is thinking maybe the gaps have shown up in the last year or two. Isn't so. We've been trying to close these gaps for 30 years.
What are we doing that's working? You said that Michigan really doesn't do that badly in some mm-hmm. metrics, and the governor's wild about metrics.
Mm-hmm.
What does Michigan do well? What resources do we have that are promising?
Sure. I think there's three areas where Michigan stands out across the country. First, in the term of clinical practices, we use more evidence-based practices than most states, meaning research-based treatment methods. Michigan's been pioneering about a dozen of them. Strong clinical training, strong measurements of treatment methods that actually work. Secondly, we have the most advanced financing system. Michigan's running what's called third-generation managed care, meaning they finance the CMH system for all the folks in the region, not per person, but across the region, and it's kept the cost low. The costs have risen by only 2% a year for the last 15 years. That's pretty amazing. And third is it's the most community-based and client-centered system in the country. We were the first state in the country to pass a person-centered planning law, meaning by law, a client has to be involved intimately in their treatment planning. That isn't true nationwide. And it's mostly community-based. Over 60% of our services are in clients' homes, schools, or workplaces. Those are pretty astounding figures.
Now, if the state embarks on a really candid review from 10 miles up of how this system is working and where we need to make improvements, is it apparent to you, as somebody who's been in this business for a long time, is it apparent to you what they're likely to find?
You know, it is. So let me just go through a list of things that they might find. They'll find that people without very severe needs can't get care. If you don't have health insurance, or even if you do have health insurance tends to be either public or private, insufficient. So if you're not insured, or if you have a weak medical insurance policy, you're going to get very poor care until you're severely impaired. And that's how the law is written. The law actually protects the severely impaired. Thank goodness it does, but it leaves a large swath of Michigan citizens without care at all until they become more severely in need. I know they're going to point that out, and they should point that out. Secondly, they're going to point out that even if you're severely impaired, the tension between treatment, voluntary treatment, and mandated treatment is always a tough one. And so civil liberties and healthcare get mixed up together. They're not easy to untangle. For example, the mental health courts are a good beginning to say, how do we mix civil liberties, the correction system, and mental health in a way that actually gets people better? And I think that's what they're going to find.
Tell us about those mental health courts a little bit more. How prevalent are they in Michigan?
There aren't very many of them, less than a dozen in Michigan, but it's a great idea. It's the idea that if someone comes before the court and it's clear that the genesis of the issue is a mental health concern, that treatment will be mandated and woven in. The term of art that I use is more called the treatment court. How do we treat a wide range of things? Substance abuse, domestic violence, mental health.
Veterans issues.
Veterans issues.
Here in East Lansing.
Yep.
Yeah.
A veterans court is a treatment court, right? Right, where the judge and his or her staff and the mental health staff are all on the same team. They're working to move it forward.
One major goal of the review, according to the administration, is to identify how exactly people end up in prison instead of in programs that could treat their illnesses. And you read about this more than anything. Is this as common as we are led to believe?
You know, yes and no. Sure, there's a lot of untreated mental health conditions that lead to criminal behavior, you bet. But our experience has been the opposite as well, that a lot of other conditions get people in jail. Poverty, parenting skills, the gang you hang around with, and then mental health conditions fester there. I mean, the prison isn't a great place to be. And so if you were to survey you and I, in fact, in a prison setting, we would show a diagnosis that are pretty severe. And so it's never been clear to us that mental illness leads to criminalization all the time. It's actually a two-arrowed direction where criminal involvement sometimes leads to, incarceration, which is not great for someone's mental health. So it's really a mixed bag, Mark.
Your purview at CMH is the Tri-County area. Talk to us about Ingham, Eaton, and Clinton counties' particular challenges from your perspective.
Sure, sure. I think over the last 40 years, we've really run a community-based system. We used to have over 1,000 people in the Tri-County area in state hospitals. We now have 7. That's over 40 years. It's quite a change.
And that changed in the early 90s, like 20 years or so ago?
From the 70s. So almost 50 years, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah. The math that I help people see, our budget serves about 10,000 people a year. That same budget would only be able to serve 300 people in state hospitals. So a 33-fold increase in the number of people we can serve because it's community-based. Same size budget. Community-based care is our watchword. The newest trend for us is integration. So we have therapists and psychiatrists at 9 community health clinics in town, mostly serving the poor, but kids and adults both. We have a twice-a-month primary care clinic at our building serving our clients, because a lot of our clients don't have access to primary care, to physician care. And in April, it'll open up to be a full-service clinic, so we're really looking forward to that.
Do challenges vary much from region to region in Michigan? I mean, do you face challenges in the Lansing area that they may not face up north or anything like that?
So that's a great question. I think there are conditions that are distinct to an urban area, but I think underlying a lot of those disparate challenges is disparate funding. The funding levels across Michigan are incredibly different. Some parts of the state per capita get funding 3 times higher than other parts of the state. And unfortunately, the Tri-County area is at the bottom half of that.
Now, how is that? How does that play out?
It's historic funding based on where the Appropriations Committee chair lived, based on where state hospital was located. The state's working to correct that, but it's been a problem for 40 years. And so I think the state's trying to move towards it over the next several years. We look forward to that. But until that's solved, you're going to have disparate treatment throughout the state.
Now, is that likely to come up in this review in any way?
We sure hope so. It's very delicate because, you're talking about finances. And these days, finances is not a popular topic, but we hope it will come up.
But there needs to be a leveling out of that revenue.
Exactly, because it shouldn't matter where you live in Michigan. Your treatment should be the same.
Yeah. Services vary a great deal then obviously.
They do.
Yeah.
They do.
Yeah. Governor Snyder said last month that discussions on school safety shouldn't focus on guns but on mental health care instead. What did you take from that?
We would agree. There was a time where our CMH center had staff in every high school and middle school in Lansing with a federal grant that ended 10 years ago. that really brought the violence down in the schools. It improved truancy rates. It improved academic performance. It improved parental involvement, all the right stuff. We know it does that. Mm-hmm. And that was a relatively cheap. It was one therapist per building, in fact. But the difference that you could do to take the edge off a kid's life and improve their lives was dramatic.
How do you deal with, we alluded to the Veterans Court in East Lansing a few minutes ago. Give me your take on veterans' challenges mm-hmm. and to the extent to which CMH mm-hmm. deals with that.
I think vets bring a unique set of challenges. You know, by and large, the vets are a healthy lot. I got to tell you that. I mean, sometimes we're not careful to say that, but vets are strong, healthy, bright, you know, et cetera. But sometimes the impact of war is significant. And sometimes hidden. You know, we all know about PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. A lot of vets come home with it and won't admit it. A lot of vets don't know they have Veterans Administration benefits. We deal with lots of vets who have been getting treatment from us for years, not accessing VA. They don't know about it. I think thirdly for vets is a lot of them, when they went into the service and came back without skills that the market appreciates. So employment is tough for vets. Housing is tough for vets. Primary care is tough for vets. So they have some challenges that are unique to a veteran status. I would say, though, those challenges are no different than the public as a whole. And so if we can improve mental health access for everybody, vets will benefit. I am concerned a little bit about people trying to solve the vet problem and not solving the vet's neighbor's problem.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Governor Rick Snyder has ordered a review of how Michigan delivers mental health services. We'll have to keep an eye on this. It's going to be interesting. Joining us today, Bob Sheehan, Executive Director of Community Mental Health of Lansing. Thanks very much, Bob.
Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it.
It's now time for a special public poetry announcement here, brought to you by Current State and the Center for Poetry at MSU's Residential College in the Arts and Humanities. Today and tomorrow, the Poetry Out Loud State Championship will take place at East Lansing's Hanna Community Center. High school students from around the state compete in the poetry recitation competition for the chance to represent Michigan in the national finals later this spring. In town as a guest performer at the event is Jamal May. He's a world-class spoken word artist and poet from Detroit, and we're really fortunate to have him with us here today. Welcome to Current State, Jamal.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
Yeah. You're from Detroit. You're the son of two auto workers, no less. So you're a real Detroiter.
Yeah, UAW blood. You know,
what was your childhood like? What part of town did you grow up in?
I grew up on the west side. Started off over like in Dexter area, and then we moved further west, Outer Drive, kind of old Redford.
Okay. And what was it like growing up the son of two auto workers?
Varied. I think that's the word I would zero in on. My parents were very kind of eclectic people. They were auto workers. My dad's a Baptist preacher, and there was a lot of culture kind of brought into the house, different kinds of music, different kinds of books.
An auto worker preacher.
Yes.
How about that? And you got into music before you got into poetry, I understand?
I did. I got mostly through the production side of it. I was a hip-hop artist for a while, too. I went to Florida, did a studio engineering degree, and started doing some freelance engineering and production work and recording hip-hop and stuff.
When and how did you first become aware of how special words and language were to you?
The personal connection, I think I realized way after it became that important to me. When I look back retrospectively, I could see like all the ways that words were important. I remember getting arguments with people about hip hop because I was kind of more focused on the lyrics and other people were more focused on the beat. And we would have these arguments that when I look back, I realized I was thinking about language and they were just thinking about just the head nod. And I realized that was probably the big difference.
Yeah. Well, I think for decades, you know, you've either been a lyrics person or you've been a, you know, like a chord change person. You know, I, th- think that's how it's played out. A lot of people, just for a lot of people, it's the melody, it's the harmony,
right.
it's all of that musical mechanics
right.
of something that's going on. And other people are just totally fascinated by the story,
right.
by the words that
and
are
ultimately
going
on. You start understanding that it's the play of those two things. I feel like both sides of those are actually being moved by each other. The people that are kind of about the chord change, I think the actual story behind the lyrics are affecting that, and then vice versa.
What was the first time like that you performed spoken word?
It was like seeing a person I didn't know. Like, it was like watching myself, because my greatest fear growing up was crowds. Crowds still freak me out, but I kind of go towards it instead of away from it. I have a belief that the only way to grow is to do things that you actually can't do. If you only do what you know how to do, then you never actually grow. And the thing that scared me the most was being in front of an audience, so I kind of threw myself up there.
Wow.
And that experience was a rush, you know, and I kind of wanted to explore, see who that person was.
Life begins at the end of your comfort zone.
Exactly.
I've heard that kind of thing. You've done a lot of work in the Detroit schools. Tell us about that.
That's one of the most phenomenal experiences of my life. The years I worked with Inside Out, it was just, I always had, as a writer, it was just great to always see the next generation of lovers of language and literature, mm-hmm. because you see a lot of people doing a lot of hand-wringing about literature when they're removed from that. They're just thinking, oh, no one reads, no one cares about literature. But when you're going in weekly and seeing kids get excited about writing, like, you never get into that space. Every single week I could see how poetry can affect people. You got classrooms of 30 kids excited that they're writing poems today instead of whatever else they were doing. So as a writer, it was like really inspiring in that way. And just as a lover of the city, it was really great just to see poetry having that impact on where I came from.
That catharsis of spoken word poetry, especially for teenagers, can be really profound. Is there a story that sticks out in your mind over how transformative an experience that can be?
I have various experiences. I worked with both middle school and high school students, and just on the high school side, I remember there was a student who specifically, when we got there, kind of was going in a whole different trajectory. He had a great English teacher that was trying to kind of steer him in a different direction, and I remember the day that he was one of the poems we awarded for the anthology. We put out anthologies for the students' work, and he was one of the students whose poem was featured as one of the winners. And I met his mom, and she hadn't seen the poem yet, and I saw her read the poem for the first time and start crying, and she just hugged me and said, thank you for being a good influence on my son. And I saw his face, like, seeing that he could have an impact and move someone without in this other way, instead of being a distraction or a problem, like this way that you can impact people positively. And I think that's probably stands out as one of the bigger moments.
How do you feel about your own? I mean, you're thriving doing what you're doing. How do you feel about that? I mean, you've gone through your own transformations in
definitely.
This thing too.
It's sometimes it's like it's important to kind of look back and remember that I have gone through these transformations. That because it's easy. I feel like artists are always kind of looking for the next thing. They're kind of trying to move forward. So I think sometimes when you're constantly moving forward, it's hard to remember to kind of be present and pay attention. Every now and then I'll kind of just look at everything that's happened around it, and like journals that are publishing me now that I never imagined I could have got poems inside of, and now it's like that's what I'm supposed to be doing. And it's so it's kind of bizarre in a way to actually look back at where I came from and where I've ended up. I've been mostly a working artist for 9 years now. That's just like crazy to even imagine.
That's great.
Yeah.
You're a world-class spoken word artist. You won a lot of awards and competitions. And I understand there's typically quite a large gap between the worlds of spoken word and academic poetry. And a lot of that has to do with race, and from what I've read about your career, you haven't paid any attention to those divisions. How is that?
Yeah, and basically the way I did it was paying attention to the divisions. I think it's a kind of a paradoxical thing where the way that I've been able to work in both sides of the fence is because I understood what was different about what you could do on a stage and what was different about what you could do on the page. I think a lot of people want to just like believe that they're just like the same thing, and they kind of are different, but there are things that are universal, like a strong image, like an interesting syntax. These are things that are universal across the different, they're kind of like different genres. They're like, whereas if you think about it in terms of music, if you're a blues guitarist, you could be a great blues guitarist, but if you are open at a heavy metal show, people are going to ignore you. Yeah. And it's kind of like that with poetry. There's these different camps that are basically just kind of different genres. But if you're a really amazing blues guitarist, you can wrap that audience's attention. So I always saw it as like, I saw the differences and started asking, you know, where can that line be blurred? And ultimately, poetry predates literacy. So this notion that poetry spoken in the air is this vastly different thing from traditional poetry. It's kind of a new thing because with the advent of the printing press, that's when poetry became really published a lot and put in books. Poems were written before people could read and write. Poetry has been around for a really long time. It was a recitation. Recitation is kind of the beginnings of poetry. Mm-hmm. So being a person who was a performer first, it's really helped me as a writer because some of my final stages of editing now are when I'm presenting work in front of a room. And there was a stretch of time where my poems were different, whether they were performance or page, and now they're all kind of just the same poems because I found where that universality was. And I wasn't so much that I ignored the boundaries as much as I marked where they were and started kind of kicking dirt over them.
I love that.
And at this point, I have way more literary credits than I do performance. Some people think of me as a performer who started publishing, but at this point, I've won way more awards on the page. never won the National Poetry Slam, which is the big one, the big team slam. I finished second at Individual World Slam. That's the highest I've done. But I've won the Beatrice Holly Award on the page. That's like, that's way bigger than anything I've done in slam. The Stadler Fellowship. I got poems coming out in Poetry Magazine, Plowshares, Kenyon Review, Gulf Coast. These are really difficult journals. So it's interesting that there are circles that don't even think of me, that don't even know I perform. They're surprised when they hear me read. They're like, oh, you can perform, you can read your work well, because they've only read me in journals. So I think that's really fascinating too.
Well, I'd really be dropping the ball if I didn't ask you to read one of your poems here, and you've got something ready. So,
yes, I do.
So Jamal May.
Okay. This is a new one called The Gun Joke. It's funny, she says, how many people are shocked by this shooting and the next and the next. She doesn't mean funny as in funny, but funny as in blood soup tastes funny when you mix in soil. Stop me if you haven't heard this one. A young man, old man, teenage boy walks into an office, theater, daycare, club, and empties a magazine into a crowd of strangers, family, students. Ever hear the one about the shotgun? What do you call it when a shotgun tests a liquor store's bulletproof glass? What do you call blood seeping into my neighbor's lawn? What do you call it when a man sets his own house on fire, takes up a sniper position, and waits for the firefighter? Stop me if you haven't heard this one. A senior citizen walks into a police station and says nothing, his 38 standing in for a voice lost to cancer. The pistol chokes when he squeezes, but manages to stutter, stop me, stop me. The first man to pull a gun on me said it was a joke, but never so much as smiled. The second said it was definitely not a joke, but before his laughter crackled through me like electrostatic. Funny how that works. What's the difference between a siren and muzzle flash? What's the difference between my student's survival and his tucked out of sight colostomy bag? When she says it's funny, she means funny as in crazy. Crazy as in this should not happen. This should not happen as in something is off. Funny as in off. Funny as in ever since a small caliber bullet chipped away part of his spine, your small friend walks kind of funny and doesn't smile as much.
Jamal May, who will be headlining this weekend at the Poetry Out Loud competition. That's at the Hanna Center in East Lansing.
Yes, and it's open to the public both rounds, which is today and tomorrow. So come on out and check it out.
Jamal May, it has been a pleasure. Why don't you take us to the break with another reading.
A Detroit Hum, ending with bones. Glass above my bed trembles at the touch of bass, pouring thunder thick out of 12-inch speakers, and I almost don't mind being jolted awake because I know this song. It's not a favorite song, but sometimes just knowing the pattern is plenty. Sometimes I need more rattle from the cabinet, more whir from the fan spinning, and a laptop warming my twin sister's lap. And when that's not enough, I might take off my shirt and press my back against a refrigerator, one of those beige monsters from the 80s you can really feel work for its hum. A hummingbird draws nectar in my thoughts. Wings beat 80-something times per second, but there aren't many flowers here. Many summers ago, I stopped even listening for bees. My cell phone near a hive can confuse honeybee signals, a natural technology too outmoded for a message vibrating in my pocket to not make a drone go haywire and spiral into the grass. Is that enough? And what about your...
Welcome back to Current State. For Friday, I'm Mark Bayshore here on 90.5 WKAR. This weekend, an art installation 3 years in the making is being unveiled. Art at Work is a community-based project built through a collaboration between the nonprofit organization Peckham Incorporated, MSU's Residential College of Arts and Humanities, and Michigan State's College of Engineering. The installation features over 100 portraits made by Peckham clients and MSU students. WKAR's Emmanuel Berry reports.
The mezzanine at Peckham's manufacturing facility is a symphony of stitching. My tour guide walks me by row after row of workers sewing various garments. When we reach a railing, she points out what I came to see. It's gray and...
pretty amazing. It's such a big space.
It really is.
On the wall, a huge curtain covers a project 3 years in the making. The installation called Art at Work is a giant mosaic of portraits. Portraits painted by the people behind the sewing machines on the factory floor. Peckham is a vocational rehabilitation center. The people who come here face an array of challenges, including physical, economic, and language barriers. To help clients, Peckham offers dozens of programs, including job readiness, ESL classes, and facility-based employment. That's where the sewing machines come in. Another service offered is art classes.
I came to Peckham in 2001 and started Art from the Heart.
That's Sue McGuire. She's the art developer at Peckham. When Peckham moved into their new facility out by the Lansing Airport in 2009, Sue wanted to make art even more of a focal point.
There was a huge blank wall, and it was 200 feet by 40 feet. And I had a vision of having nothing but artwork up on that wall.
I had this picture of maybe a small bulletin board-sized wall.
That's Vincent Delgado. He's the Academic Specialist for Civic Engagement at the Residential College of Arts and Humanities, or RCAH, at Michigan State University. Vincent and Sue spoke over the phone about projects at Peckham. She mentioned the wall to Vincent and invited him to come out and see it.
She said, oh yeah, you know, come on out, take a look. And we thought we'd find a hallway somewhere here. And she took us out on the mezzanine and said, there it is. And I said, oh, that wall is 40 by 200 feet. That is not a bulletin board sized wall. And Guillermo said, oh, we can do something with this.
Guillermo Delgado is a community artist involved in RCAH, and Vincent brought him along for the tour.
I proposed that as a factory, as a group of clients, that we come together and tell our stories, how we got here, what we're about, and share that with the community and put that on the wall.
Vincent, Guillermo, students from the Residential College of Arts and Humanities and from the School of Engineering partnered with Peckham for the Art at Work project. Through their artwork, clients began to share their stories, something Guillermo said they were anxious to do.
When I first started talking with these folks, people seemed very anxious and almost desperate in a positive way to share their stories.
Stories about standing up to oppression in Cuba and escaping war-torn Afghanistan. Many people at Peckham have limited opportunities to work with art, which Guillermo says makes this project all the more essential.
Well, I think it's important to have art in our daily lives, period. For many of these folks, then it's only going to happen at Peckham.
Vincent said as clients opened up through their work, the project became more than art.
What's developing is not a Peckham community and an RCH community, but there's a community of artists. I think if you ask everybody that's been involved in this project whose wall that is, they would say it's their wall.
The wall belongs to 61-year-old Karen Kinsey.
I haven't done any art in probably 20, 25 years.
But Kinsey decided to join the Art at Work project anyway.
I didn't think I would enjoy it that much, but once I started it, I really, really enjoyed it to the point I hated quitting.
This week, the curtain will drop, and Kinsey will have a chance to show her husband and her grandchildren her work.
Well, about my work, they'll probably say I was a first grader, but that's all right. They'll still love it. They'll tease me, but I can deal with that.
A reception for the public to view the Art at Work installation is being held Saturday morning at Peckham's manufacturing facility. Reporting for Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.
The Spartans face Ohio State Sunday afternoon, and we got to commend Joe Rexroad on his detective work this morning. You dug deep and figured out that MSU is the only team in the country to face four ranked opponents in a row in their conference. That's a really interesting detail.
And that, well, now that, of course, if the rankings hold true, but I believe they will. Of course, you know, anyone could drop out of the rankings before, like, for instance, before Wisconsin comes. But the way Wisconsin's playing, yeah, that should hold true. And I mean, you just don't see that very often. There have been years, Tom Izzo pointed out yesterday, there have been years where Michigan State might have played one or two ranked games in an entire Big Ten season, you know. So I think that's really an indication, one of many, of just how strong this conference is this year, the strongest it's been in a long, long time.
I've got to ask you, Joe, just out of curiosity, though, Joe Rexroad, how long did it take you to determine that little stat?
Well, see, you're giving me credit, and actually Matt Larson of Michigan State deserves a credit for that stat.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah. See, yes, the sports information director for Michigan State basketball, or the spokesman, I guess, he works for athletic communications, is the one who actually dug that up. So, yes, we have to give him the proper credit.
Okay. Credit where credit is due. Put this Ohio State game in some perspective for us then.
Well, I mean, Michigan State, you know, really can't afford to lose another game if it wants to win the Big Ten, I don't think. I mean, Indiana has two tough games, I guess you could say, but the way Minnesota's playing right now, that's their first road game. They have the weekend off, and they have to go to Minnesota Tuesday night. Minnesota's just playing probably its worst basketball of the season, so really the one decent chance of a loss left on Indiana's schedule is at Michigan at the end of the year. So Michigan State has to win out. It starts with, you know, a very tough game, and the next one after this, after a week off, is at Michigan. So, you know, the chances look slim right now, but it's going to be interesting to see how the Spartans respond. Obviously, Tuesday was a bitter disappointment for this team. I don't think Michigan State played its best, but still had a great chance to win that game and make a couple more free throws, and the Spartans probably do.
Travis, Trice is back in the mix. How big a factor is that?
It's big. I think it's big moving forward, and especially once the team gets into March. You know, really, Michigan State has been playing with six players for sure, and then trying to get some of its other big men in a little more, Matt Costello and Alex Gauna. But Denzel Valentine is the only perimeter sub. I think that has been wearing on, in particular, Keith Appling. Maybe you saw a little bit of that the other night. He just didn't play well. Yeah, you could say maybe it's just that Indiana did a great job against him, or he had an off night, but he's 9-33 in his last three games. And, you know, I think that maybe he's wearing down a little bit. So you bring back the backup point guard, and I think it'll allow a little bit more rest for Appling. It'll also allow Appling to work off the ball at shooting guard a little bit, which I think would benefit him at times. So I think once they get Travis Trice, you know, back weaved into the rotation, I really think it will benefit the team.
Looking ahead here, too, I see that the top four teams in the conference get, you know, bye spots in the Big Ten tourney, and the Buckeyes are in fifth place, so this is an important game for Ohio State, clearly, too.
That's true, yes. I mean, you definitely don't want to have to play on that Thursday. And now it's, you know, it used to be, of course, the top five teams would be able to play on Friday when it was an 11-team league. But now with 12, it's only four teams get the bye. So, yeah, very important. You don't want to have to play on that Thursday. It's very hard to win four games in 4 days. And so in Ohio State, is, you know, a week ago, looked really bad and got blown out at Wisconsin, but really, really responded to that by beating Minnesota by 26 points.
Yeah,
on Wednesday. So
I see, for the first time in its 16-year history, too, the men's basketball tournament has sold out weeks before the event. What do you read into that regarding Big Ten basketball and popularity and the strength of the conference?
Yeah, I think a few things there. You know, it's back in Chicago, and it hasn't been in Chicago since 2007. I think, you know, for example, you know, Wisconsin can bring more fans. I think Illinois, there's a resurgence. But I think the big thing is Indiana coming back, because they'll go anywhere when the team is playing like this. And I think Michigan, too. I think there's just a lot of fan bases that are sort of, you know, revived in terms of their interest. And then you still have your staples of Michigan State and Ohio State. And like I said, Wisconsin's closer to that than to Indy, so you probably have more Wisconsin fans going. So, yeah, I think it's quite a comment on the overall strength and just the fact that several programs and their fans kind of feel good about things this season.
Michigan seems to be struggling as well. They've lost the last four games over a 10-day stretch. Is this young team cracking under their grueling schedule, and what do they need to regroup, do you think? They face Illinois on Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they, right, and that's a dangerous game. I mean, you know, Michigan really did not look very impressive, you know, in beating Penn State Sunday. I mean, it was, you know, they were actually tied, you know, midway through the second half of that game. Now, Penn State's been playing well later, but yeah, I do think the schedule got to Michigan. You know, some confidence was reduced in that stretch, especially maybe with some of the young players. So, you know, that team's going to have to get better. I mean, Indiana and Michigan State come to Ann Arbor. I know it's on their home floor, but if the Wolverines aren't playing better by then, I don't know if they'll win those games.
An important factor for the Wolverines will be their inside game. They've been struggling down low with the absence of their redshirt junior, Jordan Morgan. He's back now. He started against Penn State. How do you think Morgan's play will help the Wolverines in the Illinois game?
Yeah, I think, he's a big addition. They missed him, I think, more defensively than anything. And, you know, I think Mitch McGarry is their most talented big man, but he's still a freshman, and he looked like a freshman in East Lansing and in a couple other games recently. So I think it's definitely good for them to have Morgan back. And this extra time to rest means that he should be close to 100% by now.
Okay, so they're slowly getting healthier, but we had everybody at practice for the first time in a month yesterday, right?
Well, fully, yeah. I mean, Travis Streich has kind of been in and out doing some things, but he was a full go. And, you know, Gary Harris is rising for powerful dunks, and you would never have guessed that, you know, 2 days earlier his left shoulder had popped out on him again. But it did. It popped out on him early in the second half of the Indiana
game. Yeah.
And popped back in. So, I mean, he's just back spasms and shoulders, but he's still one of the top freshmen in the country. So, yeah, I mean, as long as he can avoid, I guess, any serious issues with that stuff, and everyone else can, Brandon Dawson can keep coming, and Travis Streich can avoid any shots to the head, then this team might be as healthy as it's been all season here, you know, moving forward.
The Detroit Free Press's Joe Rexroad joins us every Monday and Friday to talk about MSU men's basketball. Joe, have a great weekend.
Okay, thanks, Mark. You too. Appreciate it.
It's Current State on WKAR. The 55th annual Detroit Boat Show wraps up this Sunday at Cobo Center. Dozens of dealers are on hand with the latest and greatest for cruising the Great Lakes. WKAR's Peter Wharf spent some time at the expo earlier this week and brings us his next in a series of reports from Cobo. This time, Peter talks with Bill Rose of Rose Marine Service about a boat that's close to home.
That would be Manitou pontoon boats in Lansing, Michigan. We're a proud distributor of them. We have all their models in stock. Being a Michigan-based company, they make a really good rough water boat, which we do sell a lot of on Lake St. Clair, called a V-Tune.
For people who aren't familiar, Bill, with pontoon boats, tell us how they're made, what they look like, and what they're designed for.
Pontoon boats today are made either in pretty much two varieties, twin tubes and tri-tunes, or V-tunes is what Manitou's trade name is. They have a patent on that. The V-tune pontoon boat is today's modern high-speed boat. You'll see speeds upwards of 40 and 50 miles an hour out of them. They're made to take the rough water of the lakes and still have a family on board of 10 or more people.
The pontoon boats that we know when we were younger typically had a pontoon on either side, two pontoons. This is a relatively new development, isn't it, with that third pontoon in the middle?
The third pontoon does make a difference in the boat, the way it performs and rides. They actually, the V-tune configuration actually makes the boat turn more like a fiberglass or aluminum monotype hull.
Right. Makes it more maneuverable and more stable and at high speed.
Sharper turns, more stable, exactly.
So it makes it more flexible for a boat that traditionally you think of as kind of floating around with your family, a very leisurely boat, becomes more versatile.
Yes, it does.
What goes into making a pontoon boat?
Well, Manitou makes everything there in-house on their boats. They roll the tubes in the factory. All the welding is done. Superior weld joints. Their boats are constructed with extruded hat channels that go across the full width of the boat from bow to stern. They have a marine wood deck on them that has a lifetime warranty to the owner, along with the pontoons being a lifetime warranty. Their upholstery is made in-house, roto-molded plastic bases with vinyl. We can put any engine option that you want from Mercury, Evinrude, Yamaha, Honda, and Suzuki on those boats for the people.
This is one of the bigger boats we're standing on right now.
They do make them up to 27 foot also.
Wow.
But this is the biggest ones we have at the show. We brought these down to show the people the difference between the platinum package, the teak floors, the carpeted floors, and the standard models.
What's sort of the most tricked out Manitou? Is that the one we're on right now?
That's probably the one we're on right now, or their new SR that we have with the dual lounge chairs in the back, dual tables. More of a unique family boat, so a couple people can lounge in the back while they're cruising around. They also offer in-tube storage in the center tube, which is quite large for skis, extra life preservers, fishing rods, stuff like that.
There's a ton of storage here under this front part of the deck.
Yes, there is. And they do a nice job. Everything's lockable and secure.
Manitou pontoons are made in Lansing, Michigan. I'm at the 55th annual Detroit Boat Show with Bill Rose of Rose Marine Service. Thanks a lot, Bill.
Thank you very much.
For Current State, this is Peter Worf.
Sunday is the biggest night of the year for movie lovers. Hollywood honors the best movies of 2012 with Oscars for Best Picture, Best Actor and Actress, and on and on. Who deserves to win? And is that likely to be different from who will win? It's always an interesting moment. May I have the envelope, please? The founder of the East Lansing Film Festival, Susan Woods, joins us this morning to give us her thoughts on who the winners and losers might be. Nice to see you again.
Good morning.
This is Tom Long in this morning's Detroit News says that this year's Oscar race may be the wackiest of the past two decades, and there's been an awful lot of drama over who's favored to win and just the way the whole movie year basically unfolded this year.
Right. Well, I mean, it has been an interesting year. There are a few lockdowns. I mean, there's certain categories where, you know, we all know who's going to win. But then the biggest story is Argo. This is a film that was released in, I think it was in June. It did extremely well, but that's not when you put out a film for an Oscar contention. And now it has won all the major awards. It's won Golden Globe. It's won the Directors Guild. It's won, a lot of New York critics. So now it's favored to win the Best Picture. But the director, Ben Affleck, is not up for Best Director.
What does it deserve in your opinion?
Well, I mean, I think my pick would be Lincoln. I think it was phenomenal. I thought it was an amazing film. I've seen all of the films.
That's for Best Picture.
For Best Picture.
Okay.
I've seen all the films except for Django Unchained. And to tell you the truth, I think for director it should be Ang Lee for Life of Pi. But, you know, who am I?
As long as we've jumped right into the Best Picture nominees, let's run through all of them. In fact, the East Lansing Film Festival is screening one of these contenders through next Thursday at Studio C in Okemos, correct?
We're going to be screening it until the end of March.
The end of March. We're talking about Amour.
Amour.
Right?
Now fabulous film.
Okay, tell us about that.
Well, it's a two-person film. It's French. It's directed by the Austrian director Michael Haneke, and it is about two very cultured music teachers where one of them gets a stroke and how the wife gets a stroke and how the husband deals with it. Very, very touching. And to tell you the truth, I think she should get Best Actress, but
it ain't
going to happen.
And she is whom?
Oh, I'm sorry,
Emmanuel Riva. Let's run through the other big Best Picture nominees.
Okay.
There's a number of them. Amour, Argo, Beasts of the Southern Wild, Django Unchained, Les Miserables, Life of Pi, Lincoln, Silver Linings Playbook, and Zero Dark Thirty.
Right.
Okay. And any comment on that field of movies?
Well, I mean, the big surprise was Beast of the Southern Wild, a first-time film, definitely an art house film. We showed the sneak preview of it. It was very exciting and a fabulous film, but that was the big surprise of that list.
According to the sports book site Bovada, Argo and Lincoln are way ahead of everybody
exactly.
else just in terms of the odds of winning the Best Picture Oscar. Let's go to Best Director. Again, no Ben Affleck for Argo, a pretty controversial omission
yes.
there. What about the others here? Amour's director was
Michael
nominated.
Haneke.
Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Brand New Kid will never get the Oscar.
Ben Zeitlin?
Yes.
Okay. Ang Lee for Life of Pi, Spielberg for Lincoln, and David O. Russell for Silver Linings Playbook. I probably heard more people comment enthusiastically and in kind of a surprised way about Silver Linings Playbook than any other movie this year. You expected big things from Steven Spielberg, but I'm not sure everybody expected a big thing out of this ensemble thing that Silver
right.
Linings Playbook was.
Well, I mean, the most interesting thing about that film is that it's also nominated all four actors. You know, Best Actor, Best Actor, supporting male and female, which no other film has. And so that was a big surprise. But it has not won many major awards. So Jennifer Lawrence is up for Best Actress, and she might win. Now, see, there's a thing about the Oscars. Sometimes they give the award to an actor who really should have it for another film, but the film wasn't something that you would nominate for an Oscar. So in this case, Jennifer Lawrence did such an incredible job in Hunger Games.
Yes.
So they're throwing the bone to her for this film.
Okay.
I mean, it's a game.
And again, Bovada, the sports book site, has Steven Spielberg's Lincoln way out in front in the Best Director category.
Right.
So. Let's look at the Best Actor nominees. Bradley Cooper for Silver Linings Playbook. Daniel Day-Lewis for Lincoln.
Lockdown.
Lockdown for Daniel Day-Lewis.
Yes.
Any other comments regarding the other nominees? Hugh Jackman for Les Miserables. Joaquin Phoenix for
Unbelievable.
The Master.
Okay. Unbelievable acting job. It is so interesting about that because when I saw the film, I said, this is just out of the ballpark. But acting job, but there has not been one word about him in anything, in any other contention, because it was such a difficult role, and also because he's such a difficult actor. So it's interesting. It's all this game playing, you know,
yeah.
and how much the studios will promote it.
Well, it should be interesting Sunday night. We want to thank Susan Woods, founder of the East Lansing Film Festival, for joining us this morning to stir it all up. Thanks, Susan.
Oh, thank you, Mark.
Have fun Sunday night.
Thank you.
It's Current State coming up next week. I will be on vacation next week, but we have some more than capable hands filling in for me while I'm gone. WKAR Scott Pohl, Peter Worf, and Emmanuel Berry will each host a show, as well as MLive's Angela Whitrock and MSU Alumni Association President Scott Westerman. They should have a lot of fun while I'm away. And the executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is the producer. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering and to Gabby Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by LSJ Media, offering digital marketing solutions to area businesses of all sizes, such as website development, email marketing, optimization, and more. Information at lsjmedia.com.